We're in this space and we've been talking about the theme of precariousness. And for us, this space is very precarious, but we want to know what this space signifies to you as you were here as a child and we're here now, and how, what does this mean to you?
Well, it's evolving in terms of all the potential forms and what I would call the morphologies of form, and that's always a thematic in how I organize thinking about my work and finding a way to bring it into material form. So it's very, it has a charm for me to be back with all the grotesque things that my dad thought I should know about when I was 8 or 9. And we didn't live in the city, we traveled into this museum, so he must have had another purpose for the day. But I pretty much remember that wall of the fetuses and deformed infant shapes in formaldehyde. And I think that awareness of taboos and suppressed elements of the body were always in an available space for me to think about. And I'm back, and it's quite luxurious, all these decrepit bones, and yeah.
So do you think of it as precarious? Is that the word that you would use to talk about the space?
To be here?
Or what this environment conjures up for you?
No, not really, because precariousness tends to be when I'm in some sort of fragile position and I don't know exactly how I'm going to resolve what I have to do. And this is not so fraught with uncertainty. It's a conversation. So I wouldn't say it's precarious compared to what I think is, what I experience is really precarious. It is more immediately life-threatening and larger kinds of uncertainties. We might find it. We might pull it through. Okay, what's the next question? Maybe that's precarious.
Well, we were wondering when you felt that you had a practice or an identity as an artist, if there was a certain work that marked this emergence as an artist for you, or it was kind of more of a development.
Could you get that? Was that clear enough? Okay. Well, in the lecture last night, I did show a childhood drawing of the exuberant cat, and that became such a totem work among other childhood drawings, and it confirmed this kind of iconographic continuation that sustained or emerged even after 25 years or so. I had these childhood drawing books, and in them there are the same issues and elements about repetition, about movement, about depiction, that's gone through all my work. So I never chose if I was going to, I didn't know what an artist was, but I always knew I had to make some kind of imagery, and little kids are pretty obsessive with that, but mine never stopped. So there's no date. Yeah.
Is looking back at those childhood works retrospective, or has it been a continuation for you? Like, have you always referred to those works?
No, they were hidden in some basket, and I mean, my parents did not want me to grow up to be an artist, whatever that was. I was hugely discouraged to the point of not being sent to college. I was very blessed to get all kinds of scholarships. I'm sorry, what was the question?
So you sort of answered it, whether it was, were you looking back upon those works?
Oh, no, I found them. They were amazing. They were revelatory. I said, oh, here's my same concerns, the same elements. So I have another lecture where I show all the drawings and reference them into future works. And I love doing it because they're full of affinity and mysteriousness. How did that happen? Yeah.
Did your parents' discouragement affect your wanting to become an artist, or did it have any effect on you, or did it not please you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I've had resistance. I've been scratching my way through to be able to do what I felt I needed to do. I was very lucky to have rare elements of support. The scholarship, full room, board, tuition to Bard was amazing. I had a godmother who was always a best friend and helping me when there were circumstances I couldn't have anyone else share with me. And then with my first partner, when I fell in love with James Tenney, and we were younger than you, but we recognized each other as the force field for some shared creative equity and influence, and it was fantastic. Yeah.
So in a way, let's go back to keep on this question. So in a sense, there's not one particular moment, because there's just been this continuous, perpetual development.
I never had to choose. I mean, many people have to choose, and many of my students are in a quandary. You know, what should they really do? What should they be? What should their commitment be? And I sympathize with that, but I feel a little, privileged. I never had to do that. But I really learned, I had to learn how to be an artist, because after initial, childish gifts, I realized I didn't know what you had to do. In my first oil painting, I took somebody's kit from somewhere and squeezed the colors out on a board, and I didn't know you needed turpentine, so my landscape was this gooey, sticky snow scene, all lumpish. But,
so you taught yourself, in a way, how to be an artist.
Well, the real story is when I find this museum. Mm-hmm. Is it too soon to tell it? They didn't ask the question?
Tell us.
Well, you know, when you're a kid, you have babysitting money, and you're looking for other weird people, and you travel around, and every now and then I'd take the train and get to that Market Street station, and then I'd come here, and they'd be sitting on the steps. There would always be some queer, odd kid with a guitar or a flute, and they always knew things that I needed to know. They knew about the Putney School, they knew about hitchhiking, eating out of dumpsters. There was full of important information. But then I could just wander through that huge museum. It was like a castle. No one ever paid any attention to me whatsoever. I was 11 or 12, and my story is that, you know, I look at all these paintings everywhere, and the museum in those days was not so hospital-like. It wasn't all white walls. It was full of nooks and crannies and places where you could just sort of stare at something and be invisible. And then I went down these stairs and I smelled this intoxicating aroma. I thought I was going to just, pass out. It was so beautiful. And I followed it around to a doorway and looked inside, and there are all these sort of grown-ups in front of little easels with paintbrushes. And there's a table with some bottles and fruit, and they're painting that. And I thought, oh, this must be where you learn how to do it. This must be what you have to figure out. And I hung around, and then the teacher came to the door, and he said, are you in school here or in a class? I said, no. And he said, well, do you want to come in? I said, yes. So I came in. He said, well, I can give you some drawing paper and some colored pencils. Would you like that? Yes. And so I'm at an easel watching what everybody's doing. And they're just studying, and they're really looking. All they do is spend time looking at the shapes. And he goes around and talks about how they're perceiving what they're looking at. And then the rest of the story is, he tells me I can come back. And the next time I come back, I come down the hallway, I smell the wonderful aroma, I go in the doorway, right time, and there's a class, and they're painting. And at one point, he takes a little break, and he picks up a brown paper bag from somebody's lunch, and he says, everybody come around in a circle, they do. He takes his little brown paper bag, and he just, chops it all up, cuts it up, tears it up into little pieces, and he throws all the pieces on the floor. And the class is going, I don't know. And he said, well, what do you think is the meaning of these torn up papers now and all the grown-ups? So I said, is it about all the rhythms between the pieces? And the teacher's like, yes, yes, and it's called Gestalt. So that's one of my important German words after my name. So I went on from there.
Yeah. We next wanted to ask about how you relate to your early work. So do your works mean different things to you now from when you produced them? And do you think that the works have transformed over time for the viewer? So like your performance works, do you think we would interpret them differently from people who witnessed them when they were produced?
Yes. Yes, especially the most sensuous, volatile works that had very extreme reactions at the time. Meat Joy did. Certainly Fuses, my film was censored and dragged away even up and including, I think maybe around 6 or 7 years ago, it was shown in Texas, in El Paso, and somebody called the police and they came and they arrested, you know, the poor guy, the projectionist who was making $4 an hour. And they took him. And their projection, the projectionist and the projector and the film, they took them all to prison. They didn't know exactly which was more obscene, that they should blame for the crime of this inappropriate classroom. The censorship has been constant. It still continues with my political work, my work on the destruction of Palestinian culture has been more censored than any of my erotic work. But certainly the issues have changed, so and you can all speak to that. Interior, now we call it Interior Squirrel, but Interior Scroll is in every textbook on 20th century art. That's amazing. That's astonishing. That action was considered obscene and vile, and feminists said it was playing into the worst aspects of purient male sexism. It was very confused what it was about, and then gradually, my intentions became accepted and absorbed just through cultural shifts that were happening anyway. Energy that's really lost is in the political work, the Vietnam work, that sense of community and dynamic and fierce determination to change what was unjust in the political structure. That's limping along. That's pathetic. Yeah. Over to you, you guys.
Wasn't your question also like whether the works have changed for her?
Yeah, how they changed for me? Not much. No. Mm-hmm. No.
Do you still feel like you can go back and connect to the sentiment which sort of inspired you to produce them?
I've moved on, but not only do I connect to this sentiment, but I still think I can put on that bikini and go right out there. Mm-hmm. You know, I hear my score and I'm just ready to move again. So there's, you know, a little disconnect here.
What are the relationships that have enabled your works over the years mean to you, James Tenney, your cats?
Can you start over? I couldn't understand some of what you were saying.
Yeah. What are some of the relationships that have enabled your work over the past years mean to you with James Tenney and your cats? And why is this work, is there a specific reason why it's labeled as your own instead of a collaboration?
Well, for instance, with Fuses and Snows and Waterlight Water Needle, I mean, Tenney had a whole huge body of work that he was developing, and many of our ideas and plans were parallel, but he went into my work as a participant. On the sound, we often collaborated, and the sound scores are usually given that double credit, Tenney and Schneemann, and the other works would be works by Schneemann with Tenney. And of course, the devotion, the care, the equity of the life with Jim was in incredibly supportive and inspiring. We had no money whatsoever. It was the kind of life like you probably have, where if we had a pack of cigarettes, we couldn't do the laundry. If we did the laundry, we couldn't put gasoline in the car. And for graduate school, we both had fellowships, and we lived way off campus because even though Tenney came from Arizona and New Mexico, I grew up in rural Pennsylvania and Vermont, and I was very scared of Illinois. That infinite horizon. So we lived way off campus where we had found a shelter of odd trees and a little kind of shack house. That meant that choice made it extremely difficult to provide for things because we had to drive, although the little shack house, I think it was only maybe $48 a month, I don't remember. But we had, you know, such a constant, rich engagement sexually, erotically, in terms of how we lived and what was around us. And then the cat, the original cat with us, was remarkable because she was mimetic. Not only did she play the piano sitting up, because she did it the way he did it, to the extent that when she was a kitten and we lived in a cabin in Colorado, Jim would go out on the porch to pee, and the kitten would watch, and next thing we knew, she's peeing standing up on her back legs. No, kitty, no, you're supposed to go that way. Well, that's how he did it. And she, you know, made a painting with a shoe polish brush. Anyway, that was such a remarkable partner to everything we were doing, and we learned so much from her. Tiny, very communicative, clear about justice and what was fair, and devotion. And anyway, we had such a spirit within us, and it was all very remarkable and helped us to work. And also, I was hugely influenced living with someone who was pounding out five chords of Ives, Concord Sonata, over and over again to find the rubato and the interior rhythm and all those fractures and constancies helped me enormously as a painter. I'm a painter then. I'm painting outside in landscape and being told by my professors that everything I do is wrong. So I'm used to that. I'm always wrong, except with Jim and a few close friends that included Brackage, although his feeling about my work as an artist was hugely conflicted and difficult, and then Jim's association with Malcolm Goldstein, the composer, and Philip Corner. And then after I've been in, when we get to New York, so it takes about 10 minutes, and I've joined the Judson Church, and I'm participating in Oldenburg Store Days. So it's fantastic, yeah. So there's a huge community, but it's small compared to now. It's huge in terms of its intentionality, but we all know each other. You can call John Cage up and say, will you come to my concert? He's there. Yeah. And I'm so happy now when I say Cage, you don't think it's Nicholas, right? No.
We know.
So
thank you for the groundbreaking.
So right? With these relationships that are so important in your life, do you ever consider any of them as part of your work?
But we all influence each other all the time. It's a constant melding and interconnection. Yeah.
This is a little bit of a tangent, but we've learned a lot about your sort of fruitful relationships with men. Have you had important women in your life who have affected your work as well?
That's a good question, because as a proto-feminist, the other women artists, when I'm developing what I have to do, we're all constellated around the men. The men have authority. The men's work is taken seriously. None of the women are taken very seriously. So it's stressful to be an exceptional student among your friends or a girl when all the other guys, girls, and we're girls, are cooking and cleaning and emptying the ashtrays. and for us to communicate with each other this dilemma. And seriously, we had to do it sort of on our own. So it was years before I really knew what Ava Hess was making in her studio or what Lucy Lepard was writing. My very close friends participated in my work, Dorothea Rockburn, Anina Nose, so, and the Judson people. We had a tight kind of team. But the sense around us was that we were anomalous and we couldn't really have any much authority.
Carolee, as you know, we've been spending many months thinking about your work. And
yeah, I'm so flattered and amazed. You know, that's great. Yeah.
And last week, we made our way to the end of correspondence course. And I know this is a conversation all of its own.
You mean the book, the
Correct.
Book of
sorry,
letters.
Sorry,
okay,
the,
that's okay, because it's confusing.
The,
yeah.
The book, right?
Yeah.
And I guess we kind of got stuck on this last letter, which is addressed to Sokolow at the MacArthur Foundation.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering...
I got stuck on it, too.
And so I was, one, I mean, I guess I wanted to, like, just invoke that letter and ask you to reflect on that. But I guess I also wanted to ask you to reflect on it in the context of, I think, what I understand to be maybe a shifting cultural landscape. Mm. I know that in the coming days, your archive is going to be kind of making its way to Stanford and
far away, yes.
Yeah. And so, since that, it's not that everything has changed, but do you find
no, everything has changed. There's a tremendous, tremendous interest in women's work, women's history, women's art. When you look at the reviews in the Times, at least half of them, or even more, are women. And I begin to wonder, where are the guys now? You know, it's like the beginning entering male artists don't have as much presence as they used to, where so many of the beginning entering women do. So out of early feminist research and studies in the 70s, there's been an immense reintegration of women's contributions that were lost or forgotten or are happening now. Yeah. Do you see that, all of you, now? Yeah. Yeah, I never had a woman teacher, referring to your question about women. So the influences of women for me were always dead and historical. De Beauvoir was very important. Virginia Woolf transformed my whole sense of structure. Very early, when I was 17, I read The Waves in the back of the little station wagon that came through Vermont as a library with books that you could crawl in the back and pick something. No, it's tremendous. And I said something last night that when I'm teaching and there's engaged young men paying attention, I'm like, wow, how did this happen? Yeah.
Including that letter at the end of correspondence course clearly wasn't an accident. Could you can you take us back to kind of looking back? What does it mean for that to have been the last letter?
I didn't know it would be the last letter. And that whole... All those sequences are edited by Christine Stiles. That's not a book I ever wanted to do. I thought you should be dead before you have all the personal materials organized. But that letter, that was a telling letter. I was furious. I don't know if it's clear, because I haven't read it for years, but they... What are they called, that big granting agency?
MacArthur.
Yeah, the MacArthur Foundation wanted me to recommend younger artists. I had never had one. None of my friends who were struggling and were influential and significant artists in my age group had ever had such a an acknowledgement. So I wrote the letter saying I'd be happy to recommend artists who had already achieved a great deal but did not have sufficient support. That's what it says, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what it said.
Okay.
And you also made a link. You said that the grants that you received were not just gestures of support. They enabled you to live, to survive, to make work.
Yeah.
And you had spoken very passionately about what the stakes were for how funding is distributed.
Yeah. That's still always a huge issue. Yeah.
So
to, I guess, further elaborate on the institutions, money, the economy, we wanted to know, as an artist, how that can enable or just affect your creative pursuits. Is it hard to work against the limits of the institution?
Well, the institutions are also the only way we get jobs. So I'm working against structures in the culture, but specific institutions, until they fire me for overstimulating the students or not turning the lights out on time or smoking pot off on a holiday with the graduate students, before they fire me, the institutions are solid and wonderful and completely supportive. And that's also a condition until the faculty that were so gracious and interesting begin tearing each other apart and wanting to take the course away and make their competitor have the 8 a.m. for non-art majors so that they couldn't ever travel home. And what else would they do? Stuff like that.
You're talking about schools, right?
Yeah, those institutions.
What
do you mean?
Museums. Aren't museums institutions?
Oh, them.
Is that what you had in mind?
Yeah, I guess any institution. We just said an institutional system. We didn't even think about schools, I guess. We didn't look at it that way, but that's very interesting.
Well, I mean, the institutional proportion is that I still have to teach instead of just doing what I want to do as work. But the first institution to support my work was the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art due to the interference of my cat, Vesper, mm-hmm. with the curator who was in charge of acquisitions. But that's another wonderful long story where the cat influences the outcome of this work. That's the first serious work to be acquired by a museum. And it's the Infinity Kisses with the cat, Vespers, and Clooney, that kissing series that I worked on for more than 8 years. That institution was the only one until a few weeks ago when we'll be thrilled to know that the Museum of Modern Art in New York is going to purchase up to and including her limits. That's the big double drawing with the rope and the projector and the six monitors on which you see the process of the work on the rope. Yeah, so that's amazing. But it's interesting to know that they're going to buy it, but they don't have any money yet. So this is part of museum lore. They commit themselves to a purchase, and then they have to go out and find it, and I'm told it could take quite a while. So they have to, when the curators have conviction for the work, they have to have trustees that want to back them up. And that can get very...
Maybe this is a naive way to articulate or to ask the question, but are you? It's taken too long for them to even get to this point.
It's taken very long from the culture that has power. The institutional powers have many people that are upset and obsessed with work that I did 25 years ago that they think is taboo and narcissistic, and they don't want anything to do with it. And that happens over and over again. My touring exhibit, which has everything in it, but not much anything sexual or explicit, has had tremendous resistance from institutions because all it takes is one or two trustees who say, you know, she does obscene work, and then nothing can happen. So, yeah.
So going back to a question that was asked previously about your relationships with women, we wanted to know about, in your early years, how do you deal with there not being a great sense of community with the feminist artists, and you're sort of a pioneer in that way, and there was no one to really support you and whatnot. To us, it seemed like there's a very stifling sense of community, and so we wanted to know how you dealt with that.
Okay. Standing here with all these skeletons and bones, I began accumulating a whole journal that was called Missing Precedents. When I was finally at the University of Illinois, I still had never had a woman teacher after junior high. Never, never. They weren't permitted to have that kind of influence or authority. So everything I was told was that I was pretty gifted, but don't take it seriously. It's really not an okay gift for some reason. But I had research and found precedents in libraries, odd things, or I had open stacks. Some of you might have read where I'd go with my hands up waiting for a charge. And I put my hand out, and there was a diary of Marie Bashkirtseff. Amazing, remarkable. You can look it up and research that too. So I had cultural examples that guided me. I had a few teachers that were not against what I was doing. A wonderful drawing teacher named Rox at Columbia. An important painting teacher at Bard who smoked cigars and taught me how to really grind up garlic in a salad bowl. But he was also the teacher who said, "You're really gifted, kid, but don't set your heart on art. You're only a girl." But it's a very good question. It's such a deep question. And also because of all the sexual terrors of getting pregnant, which was a big deal for us because abortions were illegal. And one of the important things at Bard for me was the red, what do you call it, the coat with the toggles, the red flannel coat with big pockets. And in the pockets was a little container. And when you opened it up, there's a little kind of round rubber thing in it, but like that. And the girl said, "This is the dormitory diaphragm, and it goes to any girl that we think is having sex before she knows she has to be safe about it. So we're giving it to you. You're the freshman who's getting the coat right now." So that saved my life until I got pregnant and had to wander off to some illegal, terrifying, faraway place. But it was very difficult. You had to pass the coat on. And boy, I loved the coat. I could go to Planned Parenthood and get my own diaphragm by then, but you couldn't just find another flannel coat with toggles. So, you know, we had secret societies of girls helping each other figure things out.
So, we've discussed your... Did you have
some... In the same vein, I guess you talked about your teachers as being influences and whatnot, but we also read about thinkers such as Marcuse and Reich, and we wanted to know how they influenced you as well.
Well, they opened my realm of thinking. You know, they concretized issues that Tenney and I were thinking about and needing to put into some formal context. I mean, we were reading things all the time from science, from anthropology, from archaeology, but it was all male culture, which was the only culture there really was until the mid-70s, when women began to reconsider what we inherited. So, does that answer that kind of? I mean, it's hard to describe how everything can influence you. You know, lying out in a field, stoned, and watching a bird wander around, that could be huge, right?
We discussed your home and in Springtown, and we read the Emily Kagan interview.
And you read the what?
The Emily Kagan interview.
Oh, good, right. Stonehouse. Yeah, yeah.
And we wanted to know about your relationship with your house and how this influences your work, and if you lived somewhere else, how that would...
I've lived other places, but I've always gone back to that house. And it's wonderful having Emily Kagan as a historian, an artist, a friend, and... helping me with things that I can't resolve myself. And her understanding of, really of everything, is so unique as a best friend. Her husband is a strange magical alchemist with a terrible disease, and she just had twins very late in life, so she's got a really enriching, complex realm that can follow anything going on with me appropriately. And that's so rare and inclusive. The house, I guess, as you read the article, that it belonged to relatives, it was a failed farm, is going to be auctioned off. And Tenney and I were sort of camping out there, and I had a very assertive, aggressive, overwhelming need to tell them not to auction the house, not that I would do anything to keep it. And then these dreams began. Do you all know about the house dreams?
You read about
them. You read about
it, yeah. But tell us about them.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's probably that same kind of crazy male voice again that keeps turning up, but I hadn't thought about it, that it was originating there. It's a dream voice that's very fierce and instructive, and it says, you know, no ambivalence. When you wake up, get a crowbar and go stand in front of the front door and stand right there and pry up the linoleum, and you'll see a beautiful chestnut beam aboard. So Jim and I said, well, we can do that. You know, that can't hurt the house so much. We'll pry up linoleum. And there was, we did, and there was that beautiful, wide, incredible, beautiful, intact, because it had been covered up. And then the second dream, it goes on. Then we're reading the I Ching like crazy and trying to figure out what kind of destiny could we have with this monumental space. And then the second dream says, take a hammer, walk outside the front door, go right, turn around, smash the wall right there, and you will see a golden stone. I know it sounds like a fairy tale, but we did that. And the cement, the house was covered in cement, it fell down, there's this beautiful stone. She said, oh yeah, it's a stone house, that's why the windowsills are like this. Because we hadn't been told the history. And then the third dream says, take the hammer, walk into the middle of the dark, dank, sad sort of living room, and smash the ceiling right there. And that's a problem. We can't fix a ceiling. I said, we can't do that. That's going to be a mess. And Jim said, we better do it. And the dream said, you'll see a great chestnut beam. And we did in there. So then we just spent 18 years opening up the house. And yeah, it was fabulous. It's still not very modern, is it, right?
Is the house a work?
The house is a collaboration of history, spirit, and my response to it all. Neighbors, it's three stone houses from 1750, built with permission of the Native Americans, the Lenape. And the second of the old stone houses was getting ruined and abandoned, and two guys just bought it and are fixing it up, and I went to meet them. I was so happy. And they said, oh, we know who you are. The other neighbor said, you're in that stone house. And they said, we have a dilemma for you. A woman, Deo, Tutwiler, those are our local Dutch names, had 13 children. She killed three of them, sent the others away, and then killed herself. I said, oh, that sounds like my kind of mothering. And they said, we don't know if it was at your house or our house. And they've written to the Library of Congress to get records, and it's still not clear. So I have another exciting house mystery.
I'll bet it's her house.
What?
I'll bet it's your house.
I don't know. My house feels very benign and graceful. But so does theirs. But that would be comfortable for me. I wouldn't be scared of a woman who had to do her own thing.
Erica, do you have a question? I do. I'm thinking about, well, first of all, I mean, your performance last night was incredible, and I think we all really appreciate the kind of risks that you took in...
Thank you.
Presenting work, but also presenting a kind of narrative of a part of your life that was so incredibly personal. And a few days ago, I had encountered something that you wrote in Meet Joy about an early experience at a Jim Dine happening, where he was also performing, but in a way that was incredibly... personal account, and mm-hmm. you, I don't know if you remember this particular experience or that.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yeah, but I'd love to hear more about that, and maybe in the context of now having just done it yesterday, how that act of
sharing, but also performing in this incredibly
powerful. Well, it was about vulnerability, because Jim Dine was already a distinguished, collected, and rather famed painter who had done performative things, as did Oldenburg and Whitman and Red Grooms, and they never lacked authority for putting themselves in their work until this Dine piece, which was a diary connecting to psychotherapy, in which he had the vulnerability and the fragility to expose part of a diary in which he was in therapy. That was so anti-masculist realm. The men in the audience who were friends of mine were absolutely outraged. And this was way before Interior Scroll or other kinds of outrage. It was a very particular male. What the fuck is he doing? That is so wrong and improper, and he shouldn't be using material like that. So I was a witness, and I thought, you know, they're so wrong, and this is so suppressive. And part of the convention in which male artists had to maintain authority by not exposing their own intimacy in any way, that would be pornography or something inappropriate. They had to direct other people or make monumental, significant works in which any of their uncertainties or failures or weaknesses would not be part of the subject. Brakhage was able to do that early on in film, but in this very sort of hyper-masculine art world, Dine was trashed for that. I mean, he never performed anything again, but he just stuck with his sculpture and painting. So yeah, I remember sitting there, yeah. And I thought it was a wonderful work. I was very moved, yeah.
Can we talk briefly about Vietnam? What the political developments of that time meant for you? We've spent some time with Snows, and we've read about your relationship with Julian Beck and your organizing activities. And mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about that period and what it meant to you as you, let's say, radicalized as an artist, as a citizen?
Well, I was, to some extent, always radicalized, even as a kid, because I would say the most prejudicial, stupid, you know, we had a National Geographic in fourth grade, and it had naked African women in it, and I remember the boys hooting and scratching and snarling over the page, and the most practically dribbling on it. And I thought, this is, I didn't know the word obscene, but I knew this is so wrong and so awful, and part of something in the culture that I was always going to struggle with. So Vietnam was a huge, enlarged, racist obscenity, and it was so relentless. The war machinery and the propaganda was impenetrable and unending, self-righteous, and just, you know, one 17-year-old guy after another was just thrown in as fodder for the killing machine, whereas the whole Vietnamese culture was subject to destruction and not ever presented truly or described properly. So Jim and I started to research it and find examples of their poetry, of their music, and as you know, this all started at the University of Illinois with an exchange student from this place we had never heard of, Vietnam. And she told us, she was an English major, and she told us that there were troops in her country setting villages on fire, arresting people, blowing up the social structures of Vietnam, and we didn't know why. What's the point of all that? So we anticipated what became, you know, a huge movement of resistance and constant sources of forbidden information and photographs that would come from Europe or through a very highly organized underground. We were called underground. I did training so that, I don't know if you found that, I trained young guys' friends so that they wouldn't be inducted, which involved putting them on the edge of some kind of psychic breakdown turmoil. But I could do it. It was very scary and uncertain, and it worked. None of them, once I got my paws on them, none of them ever got inducted. And it was sub-history, very fascinating. Like the hat, that he wouldn't take the hat off. He could not take the hat off. We worked on that for a week, that what the hat meant. And so finally he could not remove it, and so he was removed. But things like that, you could make some small concentrated effort and then join a huge activist community. You were, of course, very influenced by the civil rights and how they had insisted on their principles and gone forward to fight for them at great risk. But it was a time when we talk about, you know, sex and drugs and rich experience and happiness and great music and incredible sex, but it was also a morbid, dark, miserable surround in which people were assassinated every week. The president, the vice president, Stokely, the Black Panthers were attacked. Move On in Philadelphia, a whole village of black activists was set on fire. Everybody died, the children, the grandparents, you know, just downtown here. Every week, something horrendous, and how could you work against it? You would organize and give out information and put yourself at risk, marching, appearing, yeah, and bringing information back about what was going on. So we know even less. I mean, one of the things America does so with such cleverness is that when we're fighting another culture, we turn them into messy peasants. They don't have a civilization. They don't have a history. They don't have hotels. They don't have libraries. They don't have significant buildings. We're going to destroy them all, but you're not going to know anything about them. You're going to see them with packs on their back and a donkey, and you won't really know who they've been and what they meant. And the question is always, who benefits? And who benefits are armaments and militarists and, I think, very entrenched, invisible forms of structure, which we don't really see, but we live on a kind of beneficence outside of it, around it. You know, we still have enough privilege. Yeah. Was that a question?
Yeah. During your time in Philadelphia yesterday, actually, you just upstairs, you spoke about your precarity, your struggle with cancer, but also the art that you made throughout. And it reminded me of something that you said at one point in a conversation that we had months ago. You said that you don't choose to make work, you need to make work. It's a necessity to live, to survive, you make work.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I guess I, in the context of all of us here, I was wondering if you could talk more about that.
Well, you know, I don't have an exacting procedure, and I can't, and I won't, and so I can't even give a good outline. I think I mentioned last night, I saw a shape in my mind, I saw this shape, and I liked this shape, it was recent, and then I wondered what it was, and I thought, I want to cast it, I want it to be a sculptural form, but then I realized it had to be units, and it had to move. So for a couple of weeks, I went around asking my friends, have you seen any kind of a sculpture that's doing this and sort of several units and they're going around and they're moving like that? Because I don't know if I dreamt it, I saw it, or is it mine? And they say, it's probably yours. So I was very lucky. I had two graduate students at the time, and one is, you know, a big kind of country guy with rings in his nose and a lot of beard and hair, and he does foundry work. So he said, I can help you cast that form. And then my other student was from SVA, and he's a very elegant Austrian guy in who winds himself up and does wild kinetic things where he'll go into a car wash and figure out how those mechanics can be attached to his body. And he does these amazing events. So I thought, well, I need the kinetics, I need the foundry, and it all came together. And I just finished 12 more units. And the country guy, Joe, is up in Buffalo right now at the foundry, casting them in huge flames, and tons of sand poured around the shape. And then they'll come back to me this weekend, and then I'll call Janos, the mechanical guy in New York, and somehow we'll get them down to him for mechanization. Now, who knows where that all came from? Nobody wants to see it. Nobody knows about it. Nobody cares about it. Oh, but the beautiful thing is that we're filming, we film the fire in the foundry that melts the original form, and it's like these huge bloody blossoms. So that video is projected on the sculpture and also on the floor. So as a viewer, you're kind of standing in the beautiful bloody blossoms of the fire.
Is your process an intuitive one? Is that the way you explain it?
Well, I'm going to jump on you about practice. I hate that.
I didn't say practice this time.
Didn't you say your practice is intuitive? My process. Oh, thank you. Then I can't jump on you. Okay. Well, intuitive is everything. You know, intuitive is analytic. It's cultural. It's intellectual. It's everything that you know that you can make available. When you call something intuitive, you make it silly and frou-frou, fragile, like it's floating around, you grab it. No. Intuition is everything that's going to save your soul and forward your sensibility. If you don't have intuition, well, those herrings we're going to hang for the cats tomorrow, I don't know if they have much intuition, but we're giving them a very good outcome. Yeah. I think it's more a kind of visionary process, but it's deeply grounded. It's rigorous. It's really grounded in history and research and drawing from life 8 hours a day for many years. So I love having a huge vocabulary of form and being able to see with complexity and dimensionality and know that I can, you know, grasp the visual structure of anything. But that's a practice. That's like learning the violin, yeah. And people don't do that anymore. I still love to teach introduction to drawing before I teach media or video or all the weird names we had for media courses, yeah.
I just want to say that after spending a semester studying your works and watching your films and just reading Correspondence Course and other interviews, it's really been an incredible experience seeing you here and listening to you speak and sharing your anecdotes and your stories. It's really enhanced our academic experience studying.
That's very nice.
But what does it mean to you that we've spent an entire semester?
Oh, it's outrageous. It's huge. I can't imagine. How did this happen? I think I'm still all alone and anonymous in the same old house, shifting out the kitty litter and wondering why there's nothing to eat in the refrigerator and, you know, hurrying to get the bus to New York where I can teach or edit. And then all this is happening. There's something ghostly. It's like a strange museum is growing around me. It's enormously gratifying, but I'm also rather separate from it. And it's like I have to visit all these gifts and this great experience of what you're engaged with. It's amazing. Yeah.